Welcome to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Radio. Every week, Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller interviews CIOs of federal agencies about the latest directives, IT challenges, and successes. Now, your host, Jason Miller.
My guest today is Jerry Davis, the NASA Ames Chief Information Officer. Jerry, in some ways, this is a return trip for you on Ask the CIO. In other ways, this is new for you, considering we haven't talked in quite a while. So welcome back to the show.
Absolutely, Jason. It's always a pleasure to be here.
So you've now been at NASA Ames, when I did the research, almost 2 years. I think it was February, January timeframe.
That's correct. February of this year was a year.
All right. So we're pushing up a year and a half. Coming from NASA, coming from VA, you also spent time at education, you spent time in the intelligence world. How big of a change was it for you to come to NASA? I mean, was this a huge move or just a minor move?
Yeah, well, it's kind of in the middle. It's my second trip through NASA, between 2007 and 2010. I was the Chief Information Security Officer for NASA here at headquarters. And so coming out of VA and then going back to NASA, going to the West Coast where I'm originally from, it was a bit of a change because it's not just doing security work anymore, but as the role of Director of Information Technology and CIO for NASA Ames, it's a bit of a learning curve there. So it was a bit of a change and learning some new things. There's some things that were familiar to me, but there's quite a few things that were new for me.
So when you look at over the last year or so, what was new, what was the hardest transition? Was it the fact is that you didn't have control over all of the security coming from a security guy? Or was it the budgeting? Was it the people side, the communication side?
It's a little bit of all of the above. I think one of the biggest learning curve for me wasn't so much around IT, because IT is IT for me. And having come from VA, I had a lot of CIO type functions. I own records management when I was at VA. I own FOIA. I own WAN operations and security. The biggest difference going to Ames as a complex is kind of like an industrial complex. So there's other things I had to take on and learn. There's things around safety. You have to learn things that were totally new to me. There was because of the nature of the work that we do, there were new areas that I had to take on that I didn't have a background in, things like spectrum management. I didn't know anything about spectrum management, but I had to learn very quickly about it and what are the resources and how to manage that. So it was some learning curve for the most part in some areas, but there was a lot of areas that were kind of old hat to me from being at NASA before.
Now, a lot of times when you go into a new job, it's kind of one of those things where the first 6 months are pretty tough. The second 6 months are tough, but not as tough. And now that once you get through that first year, things get a little easier. Are you at the point now where you feel fairly comfortable with almost anything that they throw at you from a CIO's perspective?
Yeah. NASA does full cost accounting for their budgeting. And when I was at my first trip through NASA at the headquarters level, I didn't have to worry about that so much. But as a CIO, you have to be very, very attuned to full cost accounting and how it works. So that first 6 months just coming in, I came in right at the beginning in the spring in that budget cycle, and I was lost. I had no idea what was going on. And I spent a lot of hours with my staff. I have a great deputy out there at Ames who worked with me, and the staff worked with me to get me up to speed. So it took me the better part of 8 or 9 months to really understand how budgeting works at the center level for NASA.
And here you are, you became a CIO, hoping you probably didn't have to deal with math anymore. And now, boom, there's the budget right to give you more work. Just give me a quick sense. NASA Ames, people know NASA. Obviously, they know all the different space flight centers that are around. But what specifically does NASA Ames do?
NASA Ames, it's known as a research center. It's right in the center of Silicon Valley. But what we focus on, we've moved more into operations. And when I say that, we're more and more like the Goddards of the world. So we're actually building satellites, building space platforms, and flying them from Ames, which is a whole different paradigm shift from the work that they used to do of just sticking to research. One of our key areas that we're really, really good in is what we like to call EDL, entry, descent, and landing, that we do for all of the NASA flight programs that are out there. And there's kind of an inside joke that we like to say about, whether it's human space flight. We say, if you want to go to the moon, if you want to go to Mars, you got to go through Kennedy Space Center to get there, or you got to go through Marshall, or you got to go through Stennis to get there. But we like to say, but if you want to come back, you got to go through Ames, because we're all about entry, descent, and landing. So that's some of the areas that we're very good at. Computing, information technology, supercomputing, where we do a lot of simulation and modeling there. Aeronautical work. We're doing a lot of work with FAA and next generation air traffic control, leading that. And one of the big key areas that we're doing is planetary defense initiative. In Russia, February of last year, the meteorite that came in and exploded, no one saw it coming. Ames is now taking a lead in that area. We're doing some work with a jet propulsion laboratory in how we can improve planetary defense and mitigate those. It's a White House initiative, and Ames is taking the lead in that, and that's becoming very, very interesting.
So, of course, as soon as you said planetary defense, I can only think of one thing. Area 51's real. No, I know, but it's a pretty cool thing, pretty cool name to call it. But you think of all the bad movies we've seen over the years about the aliens coming.
Right.
So you got a chance to get outside of D.C. You've spent a lot of time here in the D.C. area where you talk, where you worked at headquarters offices, whether it was NASA or VA or education. You got to see how D.C. worked. Now you get to see how D.C. doesn't work from where you get to see how D.C. works from afar. Give me a sense. What's it like to be a CIO outside of the D.C. metro area? Is it good, better, worse? How would you rate it?
There's some good aspects to it, and there's some not so good aspects to it. There's a different pace when you're here in D.C., and your focus is very different. You're much more strategic, and you spend a lot of time working the politics of how to get things done. The thinking is a little bit different. When you're out in the field and you're doing CIO work, there's an operational tempo that you have to get used to. Everything's very fast. It happens very, very quick, and you're very mission-focused. You don't want anything to get in the way of the mission. When you're sitting at a center and you're looking back or you're working with headquarters, when I used to be at headquarters, I used to wonder why centers didn't want to. I said, this is so easy. Why don't they just do this? Now that I'm at a center, I'm looking back at headquarters at times and going, this doesn't make any sense at all. Why do they want us to do this? And trying to draw that balance. But the good side of it is that you can really, really focus on the mission, and you're kind of out of sight, out of mind. On the other side, you're out of sight and you're out of mind. Things you can kind of get lost in the shuffle, and you kind of lose touch of what's really going on politically, things that can affect your center, that can affect the work that you do. You lose touch of what's going on. And so that's not always a good thing. So, I'm in town periodically just to kind of keep touch with not just politically what's going on, but what's going on at headquarters and what are some of the planning they have for us and strategically where the agency is going from a mission perspective.
Is it the type of thing where it's good to be back in D.C. and then it's good to leave as well? So it's nice that you can come back every month and ensure relationships are there, understand the political side of everything. But at the end of the day, you get to go home. So it's like grandkids, right? You love them for a short amount of time, then they go home and you get all the good points.
It's exactly like that. I come out, usually for about a week at a time. And, right after about 4 days, you're like, okay. I remember this, and so it's time for me to go back to my real job and take some solitude there.
Do you end up explaining to some people at Ames, for instance, or other NASA offices that maybe you deal with more regularly in the West Coast, how D.C. works? Do you help to give them some, from a CIO's perspective, here's what you need to keep in mind of what's going on back in headquarters and why we're being asked to do something or not being asked to do something, or why is this request may seem weird to you and me, but keep this in mind. Are you able to do that?
Yeah, that's one of the key reasons that I'm there at Ames is to help at the center director level as being part of the leadership team. And understanding and articulating some of the things at headquarters, the things that they do, and how to respond back to headquarters. There's a way to communicate to headquarters and a way not to communicate. And there's also in dealing with my staff as well. Sometimes the staff doesn't understand why we do certain things. And one of the things that I do when I travel out, like I'm out this week, is I brought my chief technology officer, Ray Gilstrap, with me for him to he's been at a center his whole life. So it's like, hey, you're the chief technician. You need to understand how things work in Washington, D.C. and how they affect the work that you do and why I'm asking you to do certain things or look at certain things. I have the best of both worlds, having been in Washington, D.C., now being at the center. I can start being a translator to some degree.
You talked a little bit about what NASA Ames does. You're protecting the world from meteorites. We know that. From a CIO's perspective, how do you support that? Because it really sounds just from your perspective that you're more into operations than necessarily into strategy. But there has to be a piece of strategy there, too.
Yeah. So when we have, whether they're any mission, whether it's planetary defense or whether we're getting ready to plan to fly a new spacecraft to the moon or something like that, it's incumbent upon my office to be in the early stages of those planning stages. So we understand the requirements that are coming from the customers and how do we support that from an IT perspective. So as I said earlier, we're flying more and more spacecrafts. We're doing more and more missions out of Ames. They fly those missions from an environment that we call the Multi-Mission Operations Center. That's an environment, that's a mission environment that my organization helped to build and that we help manage. So as we know that there's new missions coming on board and we're going to be flying something, it's important that we're in those meetings to understand what the requirements are, where are they going to need, you know, that technology and how we can best support the technology. When we're doing things like planetary defense, you know, we're going to send up a craft and it's going to be looking for near-Earth objects. It's going to be sending back telemetry. You know, we got to store that telemetry, all that data. So how does the CIO support that? What's the best way? Do we want to put it out in the cloud? Do we want to do it locally in a data center? Things like that. So that's what I'm there to help shape the mission from an infrastructure perspective so that they can do the mission. And I'm just running that underlying IT infrastructure for them.
All right, very good. I think that's really helps to set the stage for our other conversation as we go forward in the show today to talk more about your priorities and such. We're going to take a quick break. My guest today is Jerry Davis, the NASA Ames Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. My guest today is Jerry Davis, the NASA Ames Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller. Jerry, before break, we're talking a little bit about your transition to NASA Ames from headquarters, some of the differences between headquarters and being in the field as a CIO. But I want to jump into some priorities. Now, last time I spoke to the NASA Ames CIO, which was probably 4 or 5 years ago, it seems like by now, one of the big things was the Nebula Cloud. It was one of the first clouds in the government, got a lot of attention. Give me a sense, where do you stand now from a NASA Ames perspective when it comes to whether it's Nebula or just cloud more generally?
The Nebula Cloud, that was it was a tremendous effort that folks did, you know, back in 2008, 2009, 2010 timeframe. You know, Chris Kemp was the brainchild behind that and handed it over to James Williams, who was the next CIO at Ames. And in late 2012, they started decommissioning Nebula, that instance that we had running at Ames, because we just weren't furthering the technology anymore. It had lived this life cycle and its purposes, and we moved on. What we did, though, was we learned a tremendous amount about cloud. How do you stand up a cloud instance? How do you build them private clouds and things like that for what we're moving on to next? So one of the things that was very, very good that came out of Nebula was OpenStack. The world is now using OpenStack, and we're very proud that that technology and that concept came out of Ames Research Center. There isn't probably a website or a place that you go to on the web today that doesn't use OpenStack. So we learned a lot from that, and we're using what we learned, whether it's security or where it's how to design a cloud instance or things that we're looking for commercial providers. If we're going to buy cloud services, we learned all that from Nebula, and we're using that today to as we look to buy commercial cloud services for NASA. And Ames, we've been charged by headquarters to lead the effort of moving the agency to a cloud environment, a commercial cloud environment.
I want to go back for a second because you talked about OpenStack, and maybe some of my listeners will understand what that is, but help me understand it a little bit. When you say OpenStack, what do you mean?
Yeah, OpenStack is using open source technology, coding, whether in all of the elements that make up a cloud platform. So whether it's the storage, all the compute, the algorithm, things like that, all the web interfaces are all open source technology. And Chris Kemp, as I said earlier, was really the brainchild behind that. And it was so good and went so well that I don't think there's a company out there today that doesn't use it for either selling or hosting cloud services.
And you bring up open source. And in fact, the president back in September made an announcement at the Open Government UN event about a new open source policy coming by the end of December to the government in terms of encouraging the use of open source. I'm not sure it's going to be a mandate, but at least encouraging it. It's interesting that kind of is all building on, if you think about the description you just gave about OpenStack, how it's being used widely across the commercial world, and then what you see kind of happening in government around innovation, around the use of GitHub and the challenges and prizes, all that is an open source platform. There's a big push for open source. Let me just take us down that path just for a second, because I definitely want to come back to cloud, but how much do you guys at Ames use open source today?
You know, it's dotted here and there. For the most part, it kind of depends on what the implementation is and what the activity that you're doing. You know, we like to go more and more today commercially, buying, you know, products and services. And NASA, for the longest time, in particular in IT, we would build it in-house. You know, I think our attitude was kind of like, hey, you know, it's not good enough anywhere else, so we can just build it in-house. But that's gone by the wayside. We're using more and more commercial tools. And depending on what the application is, if the tool is an open source commercial tool, then we'll purchase it. So I would say that it's spotty at best as it relates to open source. But we do use it. We do use open source here and there as part of some of our commercial applications. And then supplementing some of our commercial applications. We still do some in-house unique builds of technology that uses open source technology. But I wouldn't say it's hugely pervasive, but we do use it.
I want to go back to cloud now for as well, because you said commercial, if you were buying more and more commercial. And I heard a great definition of commercial cloud, and it's not necessarily public cloud. And I thought this was really ingenious, because you have government cloud and you have commercial cloud. And a commercial cloud is one that is still basically walled off from the rest of the world, but just happens to be run by a commercial company. Is that where NASA is heading, that description? So you'll have a private cloud that's a NASA-owned, NASA-operated, and then maybe a commercial cloud that is a private cloud, but happens to be in a Amazon, a Google, a Microsoft, or whomever's data center.
That's exactly where we're going. So we're setting up through headquarters, and we have a cloud service office. And what we're doing is basically building the interconnects and interface and the business processes for NASA employees and our customers to be able to use an Amazon or a Hewlett Packard or, you know, wherever it may be, a Google or Microsoft cloud environment. And it's exactly that. It's just a commercially available service, but we're doing all the front end work as it relates to security. What are the security requirements, you know, that the commercial provider has? And then what are the requirements on our customer side? So we're building all the frameworks for that. How do we bill it? How do we track usage and monitor all that? We're doing all of that so we can get our customers, our NASA customers, to commercial cloud providers.
What's the timing on this? I mean, is this something that's just in the beginning stages? Because I know you guys have been into the cloud. Again, we talked about Nebula, the number of that you've been there for 4, 5, 6 years. And then you hear other instances where NASA's moving to the cloud. I think we're going to talk about the I3P contract later on in the show. But so where are you at with this effort?
They're pretty far along. They've been working it for a couple of years now. When I came on board a year and a half ago, they were pretty far along. We did a little bit of piloting and testing. We have one going on right now, but to where it's ready for prime time and rolling out, they're probably anywhere from a year or less out to where everybody's going to, you know, have opportunity internally at NASA to use the cloud services. So it's still a little ways out there, but one of the things we want to do is make sure we did it right, especially on the security side. We put a lot of focus on security and a lot of focus on the service, because this is a new service. So service planning, design, implementation, and management, we wanted to make sure we did all those pieces right. And the team's doing a phenomenal job. There's a service executive out of headquarters by the name of Karen Petresco, who happened to be a former Ames CIO a number of years ago as well. Seems like all the CIOs go on to do great things. Maybe I'll follow along as well down the road.
I don't know how many people would say running a commercial cloud initiative would be a great thing, because the headaches that come with that, as any shared service knows. You mentioned there's a pilot going on now. Do you know a little bit about the pilot? Are you able to just offer where it's happening, or what's it deal with?
It's one of the pilots. It's within Ames. It's one of the organizations within Ames, and it's just a small pilot to see how they actually get to the service, the commercial service, and if we can do the monitoring of the usage of that service and then the invoicing and billing and how well the security parameters are set up. Very, very small, non-sensitive data, pretty much publicly available data that we're running. And it's been running now for a few months. There's obviously a lot of legalities that you have to go through when you're trying to use a commercial service. So we spend, you know, just a lot of time just administrivia on working with our general counsel to make this happen was a lot of work as well.
And I imagine that this commercial cloud offering, whenever it gets done, is only going to be at the low and moderate level when it comes to security. We're not talking about FISMA high, or are we? Because we know FedRAMP, for instance, the cloud security standards that have been developed by the DHS, DOD, GSA, and OMB are only at low and moderate. There's been this slow push to high, but not yet, I should say. So where are you guys at with security?
That's right. We're going to start with the low, incrementally move our way up through moderate, and take it from there. But we don't want to rush into things. We don't want to set ourselves up for compromises with vulnerabilities and that sort of thing. So again, one of the big areas on that security effort, a lot of work on the security side. We've been working a lot with Ronald Ross from NIST and showing him what we're doing and how we plan to do this. And we've got some very, very good feedback from the folks at NIST and from around the government in general, and the partners that we're working with, the commercial providers. It's given us a lot of good feedback and how we integrate our security with what they're doing on their side of the service.
All right, very good. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll jump into some other priorities. My guest today is Jerry Davis, the NASA Ames Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My guest today is Jerry Davis, the NASA Ames Chief Information Officer. Now, Jerry, before break, we're talking a lot about cloud. And I had one last question around cloud. It occurred to me. You talked a lot about the implementation of a commercial cloud, but how is NASA Ames specifically using cloud today? Email and collaboration yet? What about business applications? Give me a sense of where you're at and where you're heading.
So at Ames, we have a couple of small cloud instances. I think there's a larger challenge at NASA headquarters in the CIO's office is that overall you have too many centers standing up cloud instances. And which is why we're pushing for the commercial side of it. But at Ames, it's not a huge undertaking. We're not doing a lot in the cloud there. As you know, things like demand services, things such as email and things like that, those are run at an enterprise level. We're not doing cloud for those things yet. But having met recently with NASA Chief Technology Officer Deborah Diaz, that's one of the initiatives that we're actually looking at. And my CTO at Ames is working with Deborah. We're looking at the potential of doing software as a service, so email in the cloud. And that would be an enterprise service. Ames is taking an interest in working with Deborah. Collaboration is another area that we're looking at very, very heavily. Collaboration is one of those things that's very hard to solve. It's a very tough, almost an intractable problem that we've been trying to solve for years at multiple agencies that I've been to. And so the cloud aspect, there's more and more storage out there that you can get out in the cloud. So we're starting to look at that under Deborah Diaz, under the CTO's office. So at Ames, my CTO is doing the same thing, but it's in alignment with what they're doing at headquarters. But at the center level, not doing a tremendous amount of work internally with private clouds and things like that. Everyone really is waiting for the commercial availability for clouds.
In the meantime, what do you do when you have a business application that needs to be modernized or changed? I mean, in some ways, are you already running a managed service where you only have one or two data centers and everything runs out of those two data centers? So in some ways, you have a private cloud, though you don't maybe call it that?
More or less, yeah. At Ames, that's exactly what we do. I have a couple of data centers that I run that my organization is responsible for managing and developing business applications for our customers. And we'll run them out of our data center, unless they're highly specialized for flight projects or something like that. Then the, for instance, our space technology organization, they'll build their own and they'll run that instance with some support from us. But for the most part, yeah, we'll run a couple data centers. If our customers come in, there's some requirements that may be a little unique that they ask us to build for them. We'll build that in-house and run that in the data centers that we have.
I want to go back later on in the program to talk more about your relationship with the missionaries, because I know talking from other NASA Center CIOs, and let's be honest, talking to most CIOs in the government, that relationship is so key. And then we can maybe even touch upon my new favorite thing that's going on across government, shadow IT. But in the meantime, Jerry, let's talk about your other top priorities. You talked a lot about cloud. What else are you trying to get done? I know there's got to be mobility. There's got to be big data, cybersecurity, workforce. Give me a sense of what you're hoping.
So, yes, all of those. I'm one of these people that my leadership's priorities are always on the workforce, organizational development. You can't get work done without people, and it's people that drive things. So I spend a lot of time on developing the workforce. That's one of my big priorities. On top of that, what sits on top of that is service delivery. I focused a lot on service delivery since I've gotten to Ames. I spent the first year just looking at operations, at how we run things, how we do things. Are our customers happy? And then starting to focus on service delivery. We're always looking at new ways to better improve mobility. You know, NASA, by nature of the work that we do, is highly mobile. We've got people going all over the world. Ames Research Center, we're no different. We have people going all over the world. How do we best serve them? We do a pretty good job today, but we're always looking for the next set of technology. Virtual collaboration, huge area for us. We run a virtual institute out of Ames Research Center. So we have scientists that are in different countries or all over the world, and we run virtual symposiums and conferences for them. We build the infrastructure out at Ames, and we're always looking at how do we improve that. We do some really good things with the virtual institutes, and we have done some really good things this year and the past years with headquarters. I've asked Ames to run the virtual, basically it's a senior executive summit that the administrator puts on. And we run that virtually out of Ames Research Center, where we'll have 500 or 600 people on over the course of several days using Adobe Connect. We'll run that environment. But the key piece to it that we focus on is what we call the human factors. Because anybody can just run technology. You can stand up a server and stand up an application and run a virtual symposium or a conference, but the key pieces of it is how do you make it really rich in content, and how do you really make it flow and facilitate it? So we have some specialized expertise at Ames in the human factors area that work with the other centers to say, here's how you run virtual collaborations that make it worthwhile for folks and make it feel like they're actually everyone's all in the same room without being there. So that's another huge area that I continue to focus on, that we're showing how, looking at how to improve those areas. And then finally, I think one of the other big areas is big data. But big data as it relates to cybersecurity. As you know, or you may not know, back in 2008, I built the Security Operations Center, the NASA Security Operations Center out at Ames. I'm still responsible for running that because it's at my center and I'm the CIO. By default, I have to run security operations out of Ames. We collect a lot of data. A lot of information comes out of those different sensors that we have out there. And we're looking now at using some big data solutions to look for ponies that are in that data that's buried down in there that we may not know that's there. So we've brought on a data scientist through the Chief Technologies Office, Deborah Diaz, who's going to be working with us at Ames and to help develop some algorithms to help us look at some you know, advanced attacks and vulnerabilities and things that we may not know that's there today, but it's down in those logs and all that mound of data they have. So we're pretty excited about that as well.
All right, several things to follow up with you on. Let me start with the workforce issue. One thing about the workforce that's a challenge, and I think this is a challenge for you more than maybe other people, is getting the right talent, and then once you have them, so hiring them first, then retaining them and training them. As you mentioned very early in the program, you were located right in Silicon Valley, so there's all the big boys, the Googles, the Facebooks, all want the same technology talent that you're trying to get. Now, what you have that nobody else has is NASA, right? The logo, the idea of first man on the moon, all those good things. How are you doing of retaining and training and recruiting people?
I won't sugarcoat it. It's tough, particularly being in Silicon Valley. Google actually shares part of our campus with them. We've leased some land to them. And I've lost more than a handful of employees to Google because they're smart, bright, talented people. So getting people in is not the hard part. It's retention on over time.
And I want to continue the conversation on cybersecurity, too, because you mentioned the Security Operations Center, using data to make better decisions around cybersecurity, to understand where the vulnerabilities are, where the threats are coming from, and how to mitigate them. In the meantime, while that could be a longer-term effort, talk a little bit about short-term cybersecurity. We know what's happening at the Homeland Security Department with the Continuous Diagnostics and Mitigation Program, CDM. Give me a little bit more about your Security Operations Center and tell me how it's changing, how it's improving.
It's really matured over time, you know, from when I did the initial setup and implementation with the team back in 2008 through 2010. It was at its infancy, and, you know, then I left for 3 years and I come back, and I was pretty impressed with what they've done with it and what they've been able to do and the new technologies they've put in. But, you know, what we find, what it all comes down to is the data that we collect when we have tickets that come in, incident tickets that come in, and we review those tickets. We find that largely everything comes down to what I like to call basic hygiene. very basic administration of IT. So it's IT management. If you have poor IT management, you're going to inevitably end up with poor security. So one of the other areas that we're really looking at, we use the Security Operations Center for, is to look at this phenomenon that's going on with phishing. Phishing is probably the number one attack vector that we see today across not just the government, but across our areas of industry, whether it's private or public. So we're doing a number of what we call exercises, phishing exercises, where we actually craft phishing emails and we send them out to several thousand employees across NASA from the Security Operations Center. And then we look at how people respond to those emails. We can tell you, number one, they got the email. Number two, how long it took before they opened the email. How long did it take before they actually clicked on the link that was on the email? And then they actually entered their credentials as it asked for in the email. And once they do all that, if they go all to that level, they get a pop-up screen that says, hey, this was a phishing exercise. We give them a little training there, and then we can see how long they spent on the training page. So we take all that information and say, okay, here's the percentage of people that got this email. These are the percentage of people that put in their credentials and basically were had by the email. We need to do some more training. We need to improve our training around these areas and identification of phishing emails and things like that. And that's all run out of Security Operations Center. And we've seen great, great dividends come out of Security Operations Center in cost avoidance, mitigation of incidents and things like that. So it's really moved a long way and it's gotten really sophisticated. I'm really proud of the Security Operations Center and the folks that work there.
All right. Well, we're going to take another quick break. We come back. I got one more security question for you. My guest today is Jerry Davis, the NASA Ames Chief Information Officer. I'm Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. My guest is Jerry Davis, the NASA Ames Chief Information Officer. I'm Jason Miller, your host. Jerry, before break, we're talking a lot about cybersecurity. When it comes to cybersecurity and NASA, one thing has got to come up, which is Homeland Security Presidential Directive 12, HSPD 12, the use of smart identification cards for logical access, for physical access. I know NASA at one point was ahead of everyone when it came to HSPD 12, but my understanding over the last, you know, maybe a few years is things have fallen behind a little bit. I know when you got there, we spoke very early on in your tenure, and that was something you did focus on. So give me a sense, where are you guys at with logical access using these smart cards?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's, you know, so NASA early on, you know, 5-6 years ago, went storming ahead on HSPD 12, and I worked on a couple of those teams on how we're going to implement that and roll it out and all the nuances of it and the challenges behind it. Yeah, I left and come back and realized that's about as far as it went, and it kind of stalled. But to you know, the new CIO, I call him new, but after a year and a half or so on the job, Larry Sweet, Larry's done really. You know, I can't give him enough credit for what he has done agency wide in implementing HSPD 12 for logical access. So when I got to Ames last year, and I knew that was a priority for Larry. I sat down with our folks that run that aspect of the environment and said, you know, where are we with this? We had seven people that were using their PIV cards to access logically. We started a new initiative at that time last year. I talked to the center director and the deputy center director, got their support, and we started reporting on it to headquarters immediately, and Larry tracked it, and we pushed. And I believe my agency or my organization, as of about a week ago, was somewhere around 90% of our user base is using it for logical access. Now, we have some folks that simply can't use it for logical access. People in our multi-mission operations center, you know, you can't lock down their boxes while they're running a live mission, you know, where they have to log in and that sort of thing. Doesn't make a lot of sense. But of the folks who are eligible or required to use, about 90% of them are using it, and we continue to roll that out. So that's a long way from seven people a year and a half ago to where we're about 90% today. Agency-wide, I believe, Larry at his metric was 75% of the agency by fiscal year 2014 ended, and I believe he's just eclipsed 75% of about a week ago.
Very cool. Now, what you're not hearing a lot is how it's being used in terms of logical access. So take it down one level further. Number one, you got a lot of support from your leadership. Number two, you got a lot of support from the security folks, which are important, beyond the cyber folks. What was the turning point to get people on board to use it? Was it a software issue? Was it something that your office had to do to say, we're going to put readers on every single computer and we're going to require you to use it to log on to your computer, to log on to applications. What was the turning point?
You know, the resistance was just change. Change and doing something different from the way people had been doing it for years and years and years. The turning point was trying to articulate security and explaining why. What I understand about people and being in a service organization is that people get frustrated and they will condemn a process or a service if they don't understand it. And so one of the things we focus on, we held town halls and make sure people understood what our objectives were around security and having a good, secure environment. Once we kind of got that out to the staff and to the user base, to the user community, they were more accepting. And then it was a matter of literally us pushing a button to say, okay, we're going to enable these 300 boxes this week, these 300 boxes next week, so on and so forth. And that's all we did. We just started doing a very systematic process. We gave people the opportunity to opt out by following proper waiver criteria. For instance, they said, I'm in a multi-mission operations center. I cannot use it. So it was things like that. It was listening to the customer, making sure that we gave them a good service wrapped around it, and they understood the objectives. Once they understood the objectives, they got on board. You know, not everybody's going to get fully on board because, again, the change aspect. But people now, here we are a year and a half later, I don't hear any gripes from folks, you know, and so it's running well for us and the service is doing us well.
You mean as you walk by, they don't go under their breath, smart card.
Maybe when I'm out of earshot.
There you go. I want to jump over to another big program at NASA across the entire agency, and I wanted to see from an Ames perspective. There's the I3P program. This is a series of contracts that have been awarded over the last 4 or 5 years for different technology services, whether it's cloud or website or LAN/WAN. How is NASA Ames participating about within the I3P environment?
Right. So those enterprise services, we're pretty much fully on board at Ames as far as partaking of the services, the 4 or 5 services that are out there. I think one of the, and again, this is to Larry's credit, and I think to all the CIOs, we meet on this all the time on how I3P is working and the things that we can do to improve it at the center. But as it relates to Ames, one of the things that is really helped us with is made it easier to manage the environment because you have more homogeneity. So we don't have to, through I3P, and particularly, let's say, our ACES contract, which is the end user services contract, I now have standard configurations for desktops and workstations, whether they're Windows boxes or they're Mac boxes. So we can manage that a lot better. We, you know, if we have an issue with one Mac box, chances are it's a similar issue with other boxes, and we know how to manage that and do incident management very well. We have a third category, things like that are like Linux machines that more of our scientific and our research environments use. So having a standard makes it much easier to work and provide a consistent and a good service across the environment. As it relates to the other areas of I3P, things like the network, good network services we've had through the NICS contract, which is run out of Marshall, runs very, very well. And then we get into the web applications with WES, and that's run out of Marshall as well. Those are all working well together. We still have some integration challenges that we're trying to work through from one contract vehicle to the next. But overall, it's working. It's not optimal. I think that's one of Larry's priorities and challenges is to optimize those contracts as they are today.
All right, we are almost out of time. Before I let you go, the two questions that all vendors want to know about are budget and what should they know about working with your office. So start with the budget, your IT budget for 2014. We're almost done with 2014, though we have no idea what 2015 looks like. And of course, what should they know about working with your office specifically?
Yeah. So budget at Ames, it kind of comes for IT in two different buckets. Because I run the Security Operations Center for NASA, there's a separate budget for that that comes out of headquarters. You know, I manage probably about anywhere from 20 to 25 million. That's for this year. And then overall for running the IT infrastructure and participating, paying our part of the bill for the I3P contract that comes to my organization, it's probably in the $20 to $21 million range. So we're, you know, I'm handling anywhere from about $40 to $45 million a year in IT services and management.
And from a vendor standpoint, when they want to come and work with you, provide you services, meet with you, pitch you, whatever it is, what's the best way for them to do that?
You know, it's always, you know, give a call into the office. What I like to tell folks is that I don't really buy anything. I have division chiefs who do the buying. So I have someone that runs the data center. I have someone that runs my network. I have someone that runs security at Ames, a chief information security officer. So the best thing to do is call into the office or send an email, and we connect you to the right person. Programmatic things, strategy, that's what I would buy from my perspective. So they would call me, and one of the things that I look for is what makes you different from everybody else. So when you come to talk to me, be prepared to show your key differentiators that make you different from everybody else, and that you understand what we do and understand our challenges and our priorities and how you can best support us.
All right, very good advice. I think people will appreciate that. And now that you've made it clear you have no money, maybe you won't get all those calls. Unfortunately, we are out of time. My guest today was Jerry Davis, the NASA Ames Chief Information Officer. I'm Jason Miller, your host. You've been listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Jerry, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
You've been listening to Ask the Chief Information Officer. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, Ask the CIO, Thursday mornings at 10:30, only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.